Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about... This podcast, I'll give an autobiographical recount of my experience of maths. Now, what I'm going to do is go through the various ways I've understood maths from childhood all the way up to recent times, because that's probably will touch on your experience of what maths is and may help you through it. And what I'm doing is I'm limping my way to a cardiac, whatever it is, a blood test. I have to have blood tests all the time to check that my blood thinners are okay. Too few and I'll have clots and I'll have strokes. Too much of this wonder drug warfarin, I've discovered you hear ringing in your ears, so it's a bit of a task to keep yourself right on the therapeutic dose. That's just a rather amazing thing to come across. Yeah, so maths is a sort of something that people know instantly, or can every science teacher should be able to ram down a theory of maths. Now, look, I have to apologise at the moment because I'm walking via or close to a freeway, so it's a fair amount of noise that's elevated up, so the noise comes down to these poor little houses, and of course we're chopping down all our trees, and sort of the noise is escaping from the freeway into our little suburb. It's rather sad, and it's pretty sad to see the large trucks. So yeah, most of us have experience of maths. Your own personal maths might be whatever it is. I'm in the 90s and have to get down to the 80s. But you also have the maths of a litre of milk, which is a kilogram. Maths of various things, and the measure of things we do is we weigh a mass. That is, we put on a set of scales and we weigh something, whether it's making a cake or weighing yourself or weighing a sick rabbit to see how it's doing overall, is a thing that we do. But of course, as you will learn at school, weighing a mass is a sort of common term, but we get the weight force of a mass. We measure the force of a mass and therefore from that work out what the mass is. So we infer, or we don't directly measure the mass, but we measure the force of a mass and pull it out. And so that's the majority of things, that a kilogram of the Earth's surface will have a weight of 10 newtons. A newton has the weight force of an apple overall. So although you go to the moon, your weight force will be about an eighth the overall weight. Okay, the actual mass of the moon is really much smaller, but you've also got a much smaller radius, so the gravitational force increased with the small radius at the moon. So we come across the pretty much the first encounter I've had with mass, and that's from school, where you learn a few definitions. And so this is a first definition you learn at school. Mass is the amount of matter in an object. Now, that's a school definition. It's actually, turns out not to be a very worthwhile definition. It's sort of a circular definition, which really goes at the sort of hard to nail down aspect of what mass is. It's the amount of matter. So, yeah, it's that two quantities of matter can be totally different, but if we say that they've got the same mass, now we can use that definition of mass is the amount of matter, so they've got the same amount of matter. sort of really doesn't get you anywhere, does it? In terms of, I don't know, number of letters in someone's name is the worth of that person. John and Peter are equally worthwhile. Why? Because I applied this definition to them. I get their worth, and their worth is the same. It's equal to four. Sort of like but John and Peter are different, but they're the same worth. It's a sort of a very uninformative definition. And so as you go along, you pick up that mass comes up in different equations as you study. So that's when the majority of us are left with a definition which is actually circular, that mass is the amount of matter in an object. People don't know quite what matter is, but a definition of matter is something that has mass quite often. Isn't that an amazing story? But as you go along, you get a few formulas, because of the circular definition, matter or mass comes as an answer you get through by doing a process. So really saying that matter is the amount of, sorry, mass is the amount of matter in an object is basically like doing a cognitive way. You do a process and you come up with the word matter, and it's actually not a very deep process, a cognitive process, which comes up with the definition of mass. Mass at school level is what you get by doing a process, and as you study more and more, you go from the base process to other processes. So as you study more, eventually you will cover the what I have identified as the four processes of getting mass. Now, it's interesting that the last process, which I've come across in quantum mechanics, involves Planck's constant to get your mass, but it's a process. And finally, a definition of the unit of mass, of what is it, is a process where we use current balances, but actually defined mass in terms of Planck's constant, which is the quantum mechanical story. So Planck's constant is definitely a beast of quantum mechanics. It's the coefficient, the magic coefficient, scale coefficient in the Schrödinger wave equation, which relates the scale of something to the mass of something. So we've finally used the fourth process to find mass. So to start off with, your infant view of how to get mass is teach someone a circular definition that mass is the amount of matter in an object. Now in this I'm going to go through several phases. The first phase is the infant phase, next phase is the, I suppose, accomplished science phase. The phase after that, I suppose, is the getting it with the Higgs boson, that type of stuff. And the phase after that is sort of a reflective phase, looking at a whole heap of people who've looked at mass and sort of our understanding of mass. That's where we've gone. So we've gone through the infant phase, and we're about to go through the school to competent engineer phase. Now, it's important not to get too stuck up on the infant phase of matter. It's okay to remember, and that infantile way of defining it is a functional way. It's a way is to pass this point, you have to be able to produce a definition Can you remember what you've been said? What's been said to you? Yes, you can. You can actually create that definition. And so if I define people's understanding it, something as being able to fill in a test paper and give an appropriate response, I have achieved my goal. If I set my base level low enough, I can definitely achieve it. I can get a class through of kindergarten children and say, touch your nose, rub your tummy, and tell me that mass is the amount of matter in an object. So it's all very woolly. Because I'll just stop there for the moment and talk about this. It's okay to talk about mass, matter, and object. But an object is got a philosophical term, and it's basically goes back into Aristotle, various causes, and he has the cause of sort of different concepts. There's a concept of a form. So Aristotle had more a form being actually a volume of space, which you call, which sort of tags a collection of stuff inside that volume, which can be made up of matter. So you've got a volume, the shape, say, a volume of a chair. He sort of imagined like 3D printing a chair. You've got the different types of matter, and it just squeezes in there. So the object is a conceptual, fairly conceptually complicated thing, which most people refer to. An object has a name, it has a location, and it refers to specific things within that volume. And you can add to an object or take away from an object. So you can have a car, and you can add spoilers to it or something like that. But it's still the car. So it's a very interesting aspect to what an object is and how you fill it and describe it. But an object really doesn't exist in the universe. It has a... It sort of tells you equally about the conceptual machinery we have around it. So, I don't know. I suppose the classic example is being able to recognize yourself as an object. So, cats and various animals which see a marking on themselves in a mirror will not recognize that thing opposite as the object corresponding to their own consciousness. They won't go, oh, something's in a mirror, I better comb my hair or lick my fur. However, what happens is that in certain circumstances, certain animals can actually respond to a mirror. This is a key effect. So that's an object of the amount of matter in an object. There's a surprising lot of science theology in all those terms, but it's the psychology and the cognitive science and the cognitive labelling which gets inside an object. Now, we in science call an object that we're going to do calculations on called a body. So just bear in mind that the word for an object, but I'm now going to describe it as a body, that is an object that I'm going to focus on and do calculations on. And that starts to bring us up to our first set of procedural processes of defining what mass is. So mass is defined by a procedure of weighing it, of putting it in a gravitational field and putting it on a set of scales, and it will pick up a certain value. Something will weigh 2 kilograms, 3 kilograms, and essentially there was a great confusion because of working out the difference between mass and matter and objects and gravitational fields. Essentially, it was all sorted out, and people made a, Richter made a precision pendulum, which is a form of weighing. It's the, a mass creates a force, and a restorative force, and this pendulum, which he made in Paris, timed it, failed in French Guiana. This is in South America, and he then travelled back to Paris to fix it, and it was all the same. It fixed itself. It had a way of detecting the mass, had a way of knowing or changing by moving to the equator. And so what we have done is we've introduced our first procedure of determining mass by saying it's proportional to the force generating the gravitational field. So that's our first formula, which doesn't actually tell us what mass is. It's a procedure, something that we use in procedure. And so that's F equals mg, where m is the mass of my object. Now we have a convention here that we use the capital M when we're talking about the mass of the star or the mass of an object which is generating a uniform gravitational field. So that's big M. But if it's the mass of a test object, or what we call a body, it's a small m. So the force, that is the force from gravity, equals mg, where g is a small g, and that's pointing downwards. And so essentially, that's the process of when you whack something at the scales, you're measuring that force, and that force is converted, it's got the G calculated in it, and so that force is converted into kilograms. So that's a procedural method. Now, that procedure has a complexity, that it has the Earth's gravitational field and a few other things. Now, the important thing is that this all works for if you're not accelerating, but people on the equator are accelerating. They are accelerating and going in a circular orbit, albeit a supported orbit around the Earth. So although the Earth's gravitational field is correct, if you if you are quote unquote at rest on the equator, you are experiencing an unbalanced force because you're accelerating as you go around. Okay, try and feel that. I'm just actually not complicating things. I've just been truthful. Okay, so if you are sitting in a chair, perfectly stationary with respect to your frame on the equator or even Sydney, you are accelerating. Okay, because you're 24 hours, you are doing a full orbit of the Earth. And that acceleration means that to accelerate, you have to have an unbalanced force. that means that you are not taking up your full G, your full gravitational force. Some of that is unbalanced, and you're beginning to move and fall. You are falling around the Earth, but not falling close to the Earth, because you're being supported by the planet. Now, so this leads to a whole set of head-scratching things about how you'd possibly work that out. And so what we've done is we've said, right, well, the correct answer for what all these complicated calculations will be given by giving a standard kilogram that I take from Paris or the North Pole and bring it down to that place. It will read not the gravitational field times the 1 kilogram. It will read something different due to the centripetal acceleration that you're undergoing. I hope this sort of makes sense. So in order to fudge the calculations, we don't calculate. We say that's too hard to work out. What I'm going to do is that I'm going to travel all the way to your location with the 1 kilogram, adjust your scales, and that adjustment is what I would get if I calculated everything really well. So it's sort of procedural. The procedural is really complicated, a bit subtle, and the end result is that people understand procedure, which is complex and has got a shortcut on it, and therefore their understanding of mass has this shortcut built into it. Now, of course, we have another method of measuring mass, which is the current balance. There's a way that we can use special relativity. No, it's true. Special relativity, and a whole series of things to measure a current balance kilogram. But that current balance kilogram will be an exact kilogram, regardless of the acceleration, regardless of the Earth, regardless of all this. The force is supplied not by the Earth's field, but by a current field, and that current is calibrated and measured very accurately, regardless of where you're on the equator. So you will get a difference now between the Earth's kilogram and the kilogram that you use using this sophisticated technique. You'll have to then throw into the equator. You'll have to go back and do the procedure possibly. So what's essentially happened so far is even if even at your scale kilogram stuff, they haven't actually squared with you, explained everything. They have a procedure that works, but the procedure that works is not actually telling you about mass. It's telling you about the cultural procedures on a spinning planet that we go through. And of course, this means that even though you do the first thing of teaching people in nursery rhyme, the second thing is you teach them some physics, some science. You're teaching it both in such a way that you are turning that person away from ever understanding what's going on. Now, of course, there's another balance, and that is for mass, and that is, as I said, it's all to do with pendulum. There is a space pendulum, which is the orbits of planets around a heavenly body. If the heavenly body increases mass, the actual speed of oscillation speeds up. So if you can imagine, I have a planet, I don't know what its mass is, and basically I can count how many times something orbits at a certain distance to actually work out exactly how massive it is. So that's also in the same bracket. So we've got a local formula of F equals mg and a global formula of F gravitational equals g, big G, the big mass of the body, the small mass of the body, divided by r squared, the distance from that to the actual point center of the mass, the integrated point center of the mass. Now, I should point out here that even at this point in time, our textbook area of maths is, our textbook cultural version of maths is beginning to lead us astray at various points in time, in so much that setting of Greenwich Mean Time is set, has done on a set of assumptions about mass and the gravitational field. The textbooks tell you that a gravitational field points directly through the center of the Earth. Now, Greenwich happens to be on a gravitational anomaly where there's a fairly large chunk of mass and a void, which pulls the mass of that void pulls the pendulum off a few, like a tiny fraction of a degree, and So all this assumption has actually got Greenwich not at zero. It's actually a little bit off. As we come across here. Now, of course, people who are in the textbook and procedural stuff can't cope with this, because what it would mean is that they'd have to adopt something beyond procedure to understand it. And of course, as you listen to this podcast, you're coming across here. Now, not that I ditched procedure, but I began to take on other things. So you've got the F equals MG. There's also an equally involved, an F equals MA, an inertial mass. That is, you can tell how massive something is by how much force you have to go to get it going, how much you need to move it. And they're very closely related in terms of the underlying physics of the, general relativity, but also the Higgs field. Something, mass is related there. That really gives you into a sense of what mass is. In terms of procedures, this is very good. So you can tell something by whacking a rocket engine onto it in space and switching the rocket engine on, and if nothing happens, it's a big mass. Or if it just whizzes off like Wally in the movie, sort of zipping all over the place, that's got a very light mass. So you can tell, and you can tell relative masses by actually firing things at the same velocity, getting them to stick in the center, and if they just stop there, the two things at the same velocity, you can measure, you know, you can fire it at a point in time and see if they hit in the center. If they've fired at the same velocity, they'll hit in the center at the same time. And if they stick, they'll go there, or you can actually see, compare masses that way. So there's a whole area of that. Now, we don't use too much procedural thing to actually work it out like that. It's just why we don't do masses by a swinging balance. So essentially, I could, excuse me, I go to the doctor's surgery, I want to have my mass weighed, but I'm skeptical of local gravitational anomalies. Can I select another way? What they could do is they could shake the bejesus out of you, and how easily you were shaken would be how, like, if you're a big fat person, it would take a while to move you, whereas if you're light, you'd shake at a much higher frequency. So there could be a procedure of going out, and that's really the second way of measuring. Now, it's essentially, to me, at this stage, many years ago, I said, mass, it's fascinating. And of course, people would instantly go with your nursery rhyme story that it's the amount of matter in an object. And, okay. But then if they bothered to stay, you'd say, oh, look, mass is beginning to be like this girl at a party that you're interested in, but she's never there. You just hear properties of her and you hear how to find her, but you can never actually work out what it is. What is mass? And of course, 2012, we actually got that thing answered, so I had it all settled up myself philosophically to get on with my life, not knowing about it, and having that one of the fancy things that will never happen. Like, we'll never sequence the human genome. Wrong. We'll never, I think we're going to make ourselves extinct by global warming. The Chinese people will finally, the middle class will finally do its job and kill us with global warming. That's one thing, but I may be wrong on that. These types of things, and we'll never know what mass is. And it's sort of, people are saying, this is something you don't know, it's a bit painful, it's a bit, why bother? Why don't you just go with the thing that everyone else does. They just sort of like you have an appreciation for different types of wine, and everyone's on Coke and Fanta. I can't quite describe it. So sort of knowing that as a thing, you know, so various, you know, you party, you go to a dinner party, you go to a disco, and you hear about this particular thing, the mass, in different contexts. And so once you know that, you say, okay, I'm in a new context. Where is the mass? Tell me about the mass. And of course, indeed, it's there. The sort of next context is E equals MC squared and special relativity, the role of that mass has in that process. Now, when you look at it deeply, it's not disconnected to all those past two, but it's a different thing. You've got that great formula, E equals M, and if C is one, it's just E equals M. That's equivalence. And so it's not, E equals M says that if I do the procedure to measure energy, and under a different set of conditions, the procedure to measure mass, I will get the same. And this E equals MC squared is sort of given to you every time something annihilates. The energy given off is equal to the mass of the annihilated energy. So it's this one thing going forward. And it's a very beautiful thing. It's E equals MC squared, or equals M. So you've got to sort of come into it. You say, right, so as you usually describe procedure, but it is equivalence. That is, that if I have a photon in a box which has that much energy, that energy will be equivalent to a mass. I can measure it. And you can actually, in fact, measure the weight of a photon in a light particle in a field. And the way that happens is that you've got to trap your photon, so it's got a mirror at the bottom, mirror at the top, and it'll bounce off top and bottom, and it will have a little redshift, okay, due to general relativity. It will redshift as it travels out of the travels out of the gravitational field, so it'll have a little bit less momentum. So if you have something which is measuring force and two mirrors, you will measure the mass of that photon. It all sticks together. And if I can say, I don't know, it's just nicer, more pleasant to speak with people who understand the difference between procedures and equivalence, because they can't understand that something will tell me a procedure for it. And in general, that's okay. It's now equivalent because you've shown me it's procedurally the same. You know, that procedure I told about, the photon, the energy and the mass. People say, oh, understand thank you for telling your procedure. Good on you, you showed us the procedure. I can get back to a procedural, rote learning way of getting through. So, I don't know whether you can follow that, but I suppose the difference is that if you've got this understanding of the difference between a procedure and measurement and the actual component, the actual deeper understanding of it, you'll keep on going. And so, again, I suppose if you're a procedure person, you will have stopped listening. You've got a choice to stop listening. So we've got three procedures, basically, to measure mass. And there's a difference between knowing what mass is and procedure. One is you weigh it, you chuck it, and then you hit it with antimatter and see how much matter is left. You can sort of subtract. There are three procedures, and both of them dig in as a procedure, sort of scooping in to our knowledge. That's what procedures do. They scoop in and link knowledge areas together. They don't clarify things.
Again, this beautiful woman of mass has come. Where are you? Here's a curling cloud. Yeah, she likes to eat that. This happens. You only get a procedure of how to find her. Not what mass is, but find the actual understanding of her. Then we come across to the clanger. Procedures. Last ones, I don't know. They involve a transformation, information coming out, but they're not. It's not an innate property of mass. However, Schrodinger wave equation gives you innate matter and surprising, counterintuitive understanding of mass, and you feel, yes, I'm getting close to it. Firstly, the Schrodinger wave equation has a mass scale factor right there in front of you. And that's in energy section seconds, or in mass, because it's mass equivalent, energy and mass equivalent, I can put mass in there. And of course I've got to do a bit of maneuvering. I've got to put the speed of light in there. I can put mass in the, so I can express the Planck's constant in terms of an action, which is energy over time, energy integral over time, or I can express it as a angular momentum, kilograms, meters per second. Now, once you get that angular momentum, you have really grabbed my attention, because angular momentum is, it's quantized, it's bound, it's universe-wide, it sort of flies in the face of relativity. There is no relative, there is an absolute frame of rotation in the universe. Try and get that, and sort of, that's something to ponder, so it's really interesting. And then the Schrodinger wave equation simply says, I can give you the mass of something by a ruler make. You can give me a wave function, and if I can measure two parts of that wave function, I can tell you the number of grams in that doodad. And of course, and it's better than you think. If you go for really small things, I get really big. It's sort of this inverse property thing. So you can actually get some quite big things, and you can measure it by actually measuring atom to atom by transition. And so your spectra sort of oodles up heaps of high definition information about masses of these subatomic particles. Doing the Schrodinger wave equation, still procedural, but now mass has something to do with force, something to do with bodies, inverse square law, something to do with space, and now it's something to do with the essence of existence of a particle. That is, the more mass something, a particle has, the smaller it is. And you get these defining, sort of diff-defying things. And you've got what I would call nobility of photon, of quantum mechanics. The idea that although we teach everyone, it's the force, Luke, it's the force, it's the procedure, we teach everyone procedure. And if I tell you that an electron can exist wholly within another electron occupying the same space, exactly, you'd say, well, that can't be true because it violates the cultural, procedure training I've been given, that everything must have a consistent procedure. Oh, so just to give you a heads up, it's at this point in time, it's, I'm going up to my blood test, it's 12:30, and the sun is fierce at the moment. I've got a hat on, and I'm all stiff from, I think, too much exercise, and so I'm just taking up, and it's really quite punishing at this point in time. But let's get back to
to the issue. That let's recap. You've got the infantile indoctrination of mass, and then you've got the sort of like you can learn about crops by going to crop circles and cooking. Eventually, you have to go out and farm cereal. You have to know a bit more about maths. But it's important to keep your farmers entrenched in the tradition and the culture. And so, essentially, as you learn different farming techniques for maths, you come across these different aspects of it. And for me, I suppose, what is it? It's hard to say. Look, a group of friends can absolutely blast you, can tell you to shut up and say, we're not going there. But then, sort of like, you can still see the way it goes. So they go, they're off. It often gets quite boring, and then you start to stitch the story together. The story stitched together so far is your gravitational mass, inertial mass, okay, existence mass equals mc squared of r laser, and then also quantum mass, which is in the Planck's constant. So, and the quantum mass determines the squiggliness, okay, this second order rate of curvature of your wave equation. And in each of these areas, you have to go beyond the procedure, go beyond what the teacher teaches you, because all they're teaching you is what they've been taught by teachers to teach you. So it's a long way away. And so we're coming up to the sender now, and on the way back after my blood test, if I survive it all, I'll give you this story of someone who's there has actually reached sort of a zen, what is it, I just trying to think, a calm, that this is something the human race is never going to fully understand. And what's more, I'm living in an age where it is, as of yet, the people I interact with do not understand. It is not understood. So you can imagine that majesty. You're getting up there, and then they switch on CERN and open up again. So we'll get to that soon. Finished the blood test, and now getting back to mass, the more, I suppose, scientific understanding of mass that we've had since the discovery of the Higgs boson and the Higgs field. But before I get onto it, I think for the vast majority of people, they can still be very good, fully functioning people without, you know, with just the nursery rhyme knowledge of mass or any concept. It's just, my true feeling is that these people, their mind can wander, or their views can wander. These are good people, but I think they don't have anything to really hang on to in terms of understanding science. It becomes sheer magic for them. And they learn how to live with magic, or live in a magical framework, and often, I don't know, they can get quite confused. That's a sort of complicated way of saying that it's all okay to have the Nisraram understanding of mass, that mass is the amount of matter. It's also okay just to have these procedural understanding. It's just the ability for their intellect to get going is sort of held back by being rewarded for not thinking. I think that might be the answer. And I can say I didn't think as an act of rebellion. I just, I suppose, thought as I was pushed off to the margins and stuff like that, and told not to think about a certain area, but you'd still see things linking together. And the links together are these four areas of links, which is the gravitational mass, the inertial mass, the annihilation mass, and the quantum mass. All are procedural ways of getting to an area, and all things of where we use the term mass in our description of what's going on. But we have to have a really firm hypothesis for what is going on, and what is the procedure of some matter and antimatter coming together, untangling. Okay, some matter must be, for a particle, it's got to have quantum numbers, it's got to have a be a quantum number, it's got to have a knot, a topology in some sort of space, which can't be untied, otherwise it would untie and disappear. So in some form of space, some area of mathematics, some higher dimension, these particles are knotted together in such a way that a plus knot and a minus knot get together and create two particles. And somehow we've got rid of the antiparticles, and we are only left with a majority of particles themselves. And this is only the absolute, the thinnest possible leftover of actual particles. And that's together. So that's got to be there. So you've got these four angles in, four things which suggest deeper knowledge. And to a certain extent, the Higgs boson story gives you that access to greater knowledge. But as far as I can see, I can't see how the Higgs boson unties and gives you an idea of the quantum scale, i.e. The scale of everything is determined by Planck's constant. And this is a number which relates size, scale, to mass. It's, you know, the Planck's constant is equals mc squared equals m. It's got a mass and an energy. So, and relates to time and motion and space. It's a very basic thing, but how the Higgs boson gives you the Planck's constant, or how they're related, I'm not quite sure. So let's give the story of the Higgs boson. Now, to understand this, you have to understand, or it should be a good understanding to understand what a field is. And since we don't really, we exist in a gas and stuff like that, we have a sense that of empty space. We have a sense of not a field, but something being a quantity at every point within a space is what we associate with a solid. And so a field is basically a description of space where I put a property throughout that space. So a temperature field for, say, a room would be the temperature value of the would be a number, which when you put it into a computer would tell you the temperature at every single point in the room, to tell you, and that's a scalar field. And the important thing is that for all this complexity of Einstein working up on the tensor fields, that is, there is a tensor for every point in space, which sort of, you know, sort of does all the full dimensions in space. A metric. Essentially, he goes on to pseudo tensors. This is for every point. Another example would be pressure. So, for the atmosphere, is a pressure field. There's a pressure. There's an air pressure at all points in all directions. So a field doesn't do anything. A field is a descriptive term. So it's sort of like a a box, you know, a form which you fill in. It's a container. It's a conceptual container to describe a situation, and you put things into it. So in a field of space, I will describe, say, the charge field, if it's distributed, or the electric field would be the value of the electric force at each point in time. There's this wonderful description of fields by Faraday, where he invented field lines and description, but they are a description of a description, and their relation to reality is very, very tenuous. You can get something which apes a field line, like putting a whole set of magnetic dipoles in a magnetic field. The dipoles will line up on a line as if they are creating a magnetic field, but it's indeed not that. So the important thing is that in 2012, a series of high-level experiments produced the Higgs boson. That is an energy equivalent to producing a particle, which is the boson particle. And the boson particle, I suppose, if you like, popped out of the bosonic field, the Higgs boson field, which is a statement that everywhere in space is described by a Higgs boson. Higgs bosons, I suppose, a quantity. And like electric field, you've got charge. Now, the thing I don't quite understand, I have to go back into it, is this is called hypercharge. And the hypercharge is not the same on all electrons. There's all this complexity which I've got to go back into it. So I've got a sort of a gentle understanding of this field, so of this area. So it's saying that our universe is full of a space, and that space has certain properties. Now, one of the things is that the human mind is very powerful in that we can actually imagine nothing, but space itself is much more complex than nothing. So it's something which can support an electric field, the electrical permissivity, and it's the magnetic susceptibility of space. They are fixed numbers, and because that light travels at a certain speed through through space, a photon electric field can actually form a wave, a traveling wave, and it travels through space because space has those properties. If I were to tweak the magnetic resistance of space by a factor of two, I could increase the speed of light by a factor of two. The speed of light in space tells you what space is. So saying the speed of light is constant in all space is saying that all space is the same, but the same. Saying the speed of light is constant in all frame of references is saying that electrical emissivity and the magnetic susceptibility of any chunk of space is the same throughout the entire universe and in all frames of reference. Just because the speed of light is so, or you can, it's measured there. Although, so the speed of light travels, and of course time has to vary for it. So you've got this space actually having property. Now, of course, this is where I sort of start to say the way that we educate people and push people down particular paths and stuff like that, we push them off to the side of knowledge for our own convenience to teach one point, and then we don't sort of realize how we've pushed them off to the side to actually think it. So this reminds me that I'll have to get back and really study the Higgs boson again. But there is something known as symmetry breaking of the Higgs boson, which means that its potential in which it exists is a Mexican hat style thing. It has a non-zero probability of existence at any point in time, but with a like a ball in this space, symmetry broken space, it can have a value which can have any phase associated with it, and that particles can interact with the Higgs boson, and this interaction gives particles a fundamental mass. Now, this is only a small fraction of their actual mass, because a lot of the particles, say particularly the neutrons and protons, have fallen to rest at high speed. That is, they've come to rest at very high speed, high energies. And through the energy mass equivalent, they have an energy mass of their structure. So a lot of mass of your proton is from the fact that the quarks have come to rest at high speed. I don't know quite how to describe it. So there is a fraction of the mass which is equivalent to the absolute value of mass. And particles interact with the Higgs field through a charge, which is, what is a charge? Well, again, it's sort of on the same level of fields. A charge is a coefficient of interaction. When you fully pull about, you can't actually cut a particle and cut the charge off. That particle has that coefficient of interaction. And so, in a complicated way, or not complicated way, the idea of charge traveling without resistance is superconductivity. And in that as much, we are masses can be described as moving as superconductors of mass in a superconducting field of Higgs bosons. Now, if you want to move it faster, you increase the interaction rate with the Higgs field, and therefore that gives you the inertia. Now, there's a whole other thing to do with accelerating frames, and how much a piece of mass actually stretches the space around it, and the actual physical mechanism that must go, or the actual distance that space gets stretched around it, and how it goes ahead. That is again proportional to the mass. So the Higgs boson kicks in very nicely to inertial mass, and we're beginning to get some sorts of understanding of that hypercharge and how a particle is knotted together and unknots when it annihilates. So it's sort of like it's early days for me at the moment, but I'm at the stage of with the Higgs boson of understanding certain aspects of it and understanding the effects of it. I am standing up on a soapbox now and telling people about it, but in my day-to-day life I would not have anyone in particular that I talk about it. Occasionally I go back and reread papers and see if I can actually pull apart the basic explanation. So in that, we know that Higgs bosons is a fundamental. So mass is not necessarily a property of, it is a property of an object, but it's a property of the object in our universe. And there's mechanics in our universe which describe mass. And I think the simplest one to get is inertial mass. And at this stage I've got certain explanations where you get up to a point and say, therefore, translation of mass is equivalent to superconducting. And you say, well, that does make sense, that power is not dissipated and I have to put in momentum to an object to increase its overall momentum. That's beginning to make sense. there's an understanding of how mass tangles space and draws it together, stretches the space, and tensor in the general relativity. There's sort of an insight into what's happening there. There's also insight in, I suppose, it's not necessarily string theory, but topology, how the topology. So basically, if you've got scout knots, you can actually give numbers to them to count how they go. And there's certain knots which don't pull out. So a knot that doesn't pull out is a particle. And in order to leverage your knot, you have to tie an antiparticle at the same time and somehow separate the two. And so there is this understanding about how matter relates to how much energy is tied up in that knot is a sort of a very interesting thing. So if a lot of the mass is generated by the energy, stationary energy, then it's perfectly okay for the antimatter to release all that energy. It's the remaining energy or hypercharge and stuff like that to actually look at how it unstructures itself as it goes across. So we've got three things. Now, for quantum mechanics, to how a particle changes size, or how much it penetrates into space. So essentially, if it's got a lower mass, it's got a higher space penetration, i.e. something's bigger, it's not as well contained by space, its interaction with space is less. So even in the quantum mechanics, I'm beginning to see how this is linked together, but I can't quite see, of course, how this microscopic projection of, so, and say an electron, although a stationary electron, although it's not moving, it has a gradient of existence, and for that gradient of existence, you can assign momentums. So you can actually sort of see that if it's got more hypercharge hooks to the outside world, it will be, the outside will grab it more tightly and it will actually shrink the size of it. So there again, I haven't read papers that support that view or people that have come through and analysed it there. But it is, I suppose you're catching me at the stage of, well, I don't know, so I've been knocked out flat. Had been reading a bit about this, read a bit more, and so I've been knocked out flat again. And getting back onto it. So I'll get onto the high horse, and it's quite an honest description of where I'm at in terms of I'd become to peace with the different levels, the nursery rhyme level, the procedural level of understanding it. And now this has got a slightly more insight story. There is not a full explanation, but a path of explanation to look at, and the paths are beginning to lead together to a bigger explanation. I don't think yet we have a way of kiddies. Today we're going to learn about Higgs boson, and at the end of this lesson you will understand inertial, gravitational, annihilation, and quantum aspects of mass. You know, I don't think we're coming to that point, because I don't think the lessons and the analogies have been forced out yet, given that it's only 6 years since the discovery, and the way that we're structured, we're not on the ball, and we haven't actually got the hang of explaining quantum mechanics. Even though it was discovered nearly 100 years ago, we still just drop the ball and revert to script, which reinforces people's perception of being a great teacher, and contempt of other people who aren't teaching their way, and of course a huge swathe of the population for this is a mystery. And people actually get rewarded for saying quantum mechanics is weird, or it violates this, or there's this paradox here, when they themselves don't fully understand the actual intricacies of the paradox, or haven't actually used quantum mechanics to actually solve any practical real world problems. It's a weird place. So I think we're in a weird place now. So if you've got those three levels that I've gone through, and so I think I'm pretty confident that I understand at least the structure of what's going on at the nursery rhyme level. I do have an overview of what's going at the procedural level. The insight level, I'm just barely scratching the surface. But then there's another level, which is looking back over these three levels and looking further back in time to see how mass was born. And it was born by this person called Giles of Rome. And I won't give you the story that comes out in physics textbooks. He was trying to discombobulate theological nominative problems. So if you like, the scholasticism is which is the medieval way of thinking, is a very much book learning, book stuff. But at the end, it's a declarative mode of understanding with no basis in actual science. I declare this, he declares that. If I declare this and that, what's the result? There's deductive logic, which you can do through scholasticism. And so with a series of explanations, they can sort of get in there. And given that the moon and the sun keep on going around, and rocks that I throw around, or if I try to make a device on Earth, it will just come to a grinding halt, screaming halt. Therefore, the physics of Earth is different from the physics of heaven, which is exactly right, because Earth's got an atmosphere and a gravitational field, which is sort of balanced by physical interaction with the electrons of the Earth itself, the big Fermi sphere we're sitting on. So that is right. However, the theory, feeding that back into the declarative engine, you then declared that there's two levels of physics. And then if you introduce sufficient numbers of declarations into this engine, it's sort of like you can't but help generate speculation, which has got nothing to do with observation. And so the speculation was that, by Giles of Rome, is that there had to be a distinction between, because if these things are of different nature, they're of a different matter, but they have to be of the same origin, they have to have the same mass. And so he began to actually tease apart the concept that different matter can have a constant association with it, and that sort of slept there. That sort of hint slipped there to be picked up by Newton, who needed to use it. So it's sort of like matter actually came to us through sheer confusion and half-thoughts, and it's therefore not surprising that we actually can pick up, we're sort of working out what it is after it, because we really had no idea of what it is. And essentially what we're still, I think we've got a clearer idea of, you know, we know a lot more about it, but we still have these questions, like how do I determine the hypercharge of a particle? You know, what, it doesn't seem quantized, it seems, you know, something bizarre. You know, how does this go? There's these things that I still think we don't understand. But the important thing is that At no point in history have we ever really understood maths. We have sort of discussed maths in terms of we have used maths as a label for problems and then used sort of declaratively, given birth to maths as a solution to problems. I suppose you can hear this big truck coming as I'm slowly walking home from my own car. Okay, there's certainly is picking up around here. I'm walking up past the pub. Oops, here. We never understood maths. We've only ever talked about the problem of not understanding it and given that problem a name, so to speak, to come through. Now, the interesting thing is that Giles of Rome, besides having concepts which are thoroughly wacky, and just having it as a tablet set that you can use, they also had the thoroughly wacky idea of angel time. That is, instantaneous. Things can instantaneously occur in any order. And this angel time is another thing where the angel time was by definition beyond our comprehension. And this out allowed sort of a clever person to actually scoop up ideas beyond comprehension. And to me it's fascinating that see Newton and Einstein, the two great fonts of producing new ideas, operate in sort of a very spiritual, mystic way, in the way that they thought about problems. And I suppose been trying to connect with this, to try and understand where it's all come from. And so I think we have got this dilemma now, because once you are aware that you're teaching a nursery rhyme and that we really don't understand, and that matter is code word for I don't understand what this is yet, mate, come back to me. But I can tell you, if you've got that problem, that sort of problem, you do this. It's sort of like internet help. Something goes wrong with your code, you look up help, it says do this, you do not understand why that particularly works. So we, at the end of the day, really don't know why maths and science works. We're getting closer to it, and with instruments, methodologies and culture, but we simply don't understand it. And it's one of these things that if I started off a podcast saying I'm going to talk about something which is we don't understand, I'd perhaps lose everybody. And it's that point that it depends. I suppose it's the difference between a bushwalker and a swaggy. A bushwalker will have supplies, a date, a life, and they will go into the bush and they'll experience it, but they'll come out again and continue to new life. Whereas a swaggy, which is, they don't exist in Australia anymore, there's a few sort of homeless people, I suppose, would be closer to our swaggies. These would be people in the Great Depression who just had a blanket on their back, rolled up in the back, and a little packet of possessions and their shoes, and they'd just wander off into the bush looking for work, living off the land, just with no particular end in sight, but it's their position was their existence. There was a unity between the two things, and I think that describes myself at the moment. I'm a bit of a swagman trying to actually do the maths type of stuff, and I must admit, I hear people clinking drinks and having a sing-along by the pianola across the valley. I can see the warmth of their fire, and they've created a world around them, also warmth in their cottage, and that's where, that's their universe. My universe is sort of a bigger universe of, I'm not saying it's a better universe, it's a sort of a swanky universe where you look up at the sky at night and you see the whole universe, and there's really nothing there, and you have no one to speak to, but you have the memories, the echoes of past conversations and books that you've read, and it's all sort of coming together trying to get there. And so in a year I should be able to get enough time to study the Higgs boson and just see how much further I get. But I sort of get a feeling that as you go, you'll get more and more understanding. I think the critical thing to go to, which sort of has swayed me in saying, yes, this has got a lot of stuff, is the fact that it's the symmetry is broken. The actual zero is off zero. Like the zero of Higgs boson is off zero. So its minimum energy state is, it exists everywhere. So there's a circle of jaw-dropping arguments which seem just so pleasantly simple, yet so a dagger to people who are living in the procedural universe. So I'm just going to continue swagging away, and hopefully it inspired at least one or two people to have a similar interest and peace with the concept of mass. Thanks for listening.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.